Oh gosh, I mean, when you design a trail, just you really have to look at from the perspective of water and where water flows.
At first glance, trail use and water may not seem connected, but creating and maintaining trails involves keeping those trails accessible to the public. And trails are heavily impacted by the behavior of water, and then by the behavior of humans. On this episode, we'll explore how water can be the biggest contributing factor to a trail's continuing accessibility and relationship to the surrounding ecosystem, and how we as the human element can further impact the situation, either negatively or positively. If you have ever helped to design or create a trail, or participated in trail maintenance, then this is the episode for you. I'm Bethany Howell, Public Education, Participation, and Outreach Liaison for the Rio Grande Basin Roundtable, and you're listening to the Big River Podcast, Stories of the Rio Grande. With me today to help introduce our podcast guests is Jeremiah McComas, another sixth grader from Del Norte. And Jeremiah, what's your favorite thing to do during the summer?
I would say swimming in the river.
Awesome. Well, take it away.
Guests on today's episode include McDaniel and Patrick Ortiz of SLV Go, trail crew members of the GOATS, Aiden Howell, Southwest Conservation Corps trail crew member.
Trails see anything and everything, from foot traffic, mountain and dirt bikes, to horses and ATVs. Talking with my friends and family who use trails in all those ways, plus my own experiences hiking and running trails across the San Luis Valley, we're seeing more and more users each season, and we're increasing the number of accessible trails. I wanted to better understand the relationship between us, our trails, and the different forms that water can take in those areas, such as monsoons, spring runoff, snowmelt, and more. As I put together this episode, I started in what felt like summer, only to have an epic snow event while in production. I'm recording this introduction while snow piles still sit in the shady parts of my yard, and my creek is roaring from fall runoff. I couldn't have asked for a more perfect illustration of the unexpectedness of water events in our basin.
But enough about the craziness of weather in 2020. Let's talk to two of my go-to trail guys, Mick Daniel and Patrick Ortiz of San Luis Valley Great Outdoors.
SLV Go is one of the up-and-coming trails organizations that have exploded the number of accessible trails in the San Luis Valley. Since they also have recently begun exploring the world of podcasts, we thought that this would be a perfect topic to do a crossover episode. I'm so excited to talk with SLV Go staff and their newly formed GOAT team, some of the people who are down in the literal trenches to understand how everyday trail use impacts their work. I start by meeting Mick and Patrick at the Rito Seco Trailhead. Mick came to the Valley several years ago via Oklahoma, North Carolina, left for a couple of years to Oregon, and moved back to become SLV Go's executive director a few years ago. He's a seasoned educator and avid trail user, and spends a lot of his time seeking out partnerships and collaborations with Valley organizations. Patrick is a San Luis Valley native, born and raised in Alamosa. His trail experience is comprehensive. He spent a lot of time working on trail crews around the country before coming back to the SLV as Go's community engagement coordinator. They have both devoted an immense amount of time to helping get this particular trail project up and running. This area of Costilla County has an amazingly rich history, completely deserving of its own episode on this podcast. For now, I'll just introduce it by saying the Rito Seco area is one of the very few pieces of public land in Costilla County, and it just became designated as a Colorado Parks and Wildlife State Wildlife Area. It's a hidden gem, a few hundred feet in elevation above the scrub brush desert, which is only a few miles away, surrounded by aspen, pine, spruce, and accompanied the entire trail length by the Rito Seco flowing out of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. This area has actually been populated for many years, first by Native Americans, later by fur trappers and traders, and finally settled as the first permanent community in Colorado in 1852. As we walk through the trail, we see the remains of long abandoned cabins.
They're cabin foundations now, but and we think our understanding was, we got this story from one of the women, was that she had grown up in one of these cabins, and this had been a sawmill, a lumber yard in here. So they were harvesting, and they had some kind of portable sawmill they were working on, and that was the history. And we didn't really know what the history was before that. That was the first we really heard.
As the Go Guys walk and talk with me, I am floored by how much thought and understanding of water movement actually goes into trail construction. And I thought I knew quite a bit already.
And the thing is, on Forest Service and BLM, these are historic trails that were built like by people on horses or covered wagons. And it was kind of just trying to get to a destination as quick as possible.
And a lot of times they were actually just like old animal tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, game trails.
Native Americans started following.
Yep.
You know, and then first explorers, white explorers came along, and they started following those tracks. And then horses, then wagons.
So it might not have always been. Yeah, and I think that's a new thing to think about. New trails that we're creating, we have that luxury of thinking about all the things that go into it. But these older historic trails.
There was no design thought put into it.
Get from A to B the quickest way possible.
And now sustainable trails is a huge thing, because we see, you know, with monsoons and flooding that happen in popular trails, people are like, my favorite trail is closed now because of a washout. You know, so it's if you're making new trails, you try to plan for that high rainfall in certain areas, and trying to just make it flow and drain well. That's the main goal, I think, is making sure that the trail gets water off as quickly as possible.
I think that's a really great distinction. Whether or not you're using a historic trail or a new trail does make a huge difference to those water events when those happen.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny. When I first started mountain biking in the late 80s, early 90s.
Stone Age. Very long time ago.
Like, there were no purpose-built mountain bike trails. And there were definitely, trail construction hadn't reached a place yet where people were thinking about trails in that way. They were maintaining the tracks that were there, if that makes sense. And so some of those trails are still, like, they're some of my favorite trails ever, but they're, like, water bars and big drops. They weren't made for riding a bike on. They were made for walking and horses, you know. But they add some technical challenges that now we've completely, we don't even do those techniques anymore when we build a trail. We do them when we maintain them still, because we obviously need a way to stop water. But all current designs and layouts, like, you just don't achieve those grades that are too steep to ride.
So is that why it's important for people to really think about really adhering to what the signs say about why these trails are used the way they are, if they're signed for only foot use?
Exactly.
And then you add, you know, a horse, that's not the way that the trail was intended to be used. So, of course, it's going to degrade it even faster.
Yeah. Right. We had some users that were interested in maybe riding horseback on the Alamosa trails. We totally didn't design it for that at all, because the ground surface there is just, you know, it's predominantly sand. And so that would make other users, just because of the weight of the horse and the way the horse walks in a trail, like, that would require hardening. And it's not impossible. We could harden the trail. It's just now we'd have to go back and think through that and add crusher fines or some other.
So there's a reason behind the signage, I guess. So I'm trying to get to is that. That it is a big deal when you don't use a trail correctly. And it's not because people are just arbitrarily putting up signs that say, well, we don't want your side-by-side here. There's actually a reason behind it.
There's a reason. Yeah, there's a reason behind that. And sometimes it's also how it's funded, right? Like, in Colorado, we have non-motorized state trail grants and motorized state trail grants. And so if it can be a shared use trail, like, we can probably get the money to fund it faster. And then non-motorized is a little bit more difficult to get, and limits use.
But that's something you have to think about when you're actually building the trail is what time of year you're building it, and then what the potential.
What's it going to look like?
Yeah, 10 to 15 years down the road.
Yeah, it's really seeing, like, where the highest level that's cut into a stream would be. That's like the historic flood line, I'd say.
But then, you know, once we get down on the valley floor, we have all these ephemeral wetlands, you know, that in the spring they're wet, but the rest of the year they're dry. You know, we constructed a trail knowing what we knew, but by 19, when it was a really wet year, like, the trails were shut down for most of the summer. You know, it wasn't just the high water year. It was also learning how to communicate with people who are controlling the irrigation ditches and the city's water allotment. And because before that, there'd never been any need. So if it flooded out the whole area, it just didn't matter because no recreation was in there. But since that, we had that kind of water. That's one of those areas where water and recreation suddenly, like, met. And really, there was no reason to flood it to that level. It was outside the banks of the Oxbow Lake. It was beyond that, you know. So it was just about, oh, let's control the water that you're holding here to stay within the Oxbow Lake, you know, within its bounds, and not actually flood this entire forest system.
Yeah.
And so this is an erosion control feature. And basically...
And so we're looking at a bunch of rocks that have been laid out. Some of them are kind of flat.
These are actually all buried long ways.
Okay.
Sorry, it's impossible to see that here. So the biggest and longest rocks are buried directly vertical into the ground. And then each consecutive layer is stacked going up. And it does two things. So we knew that this would be a place where mountain bikes, horses, walkers would all dig heels in, or their tires would break.
Because it's a downhill grade.
Because it's a downhill grade. Or an uphill grade, right?
Depending which way you're going.
Right. And so we knew that that would happen. And so, you know, everybody's seen the ruts that are made in trails. So when we put a feature like this in, it keeps it from rutting, and therefore it keeps it from channeling water that's going to run down the trail eventually.
And then wash out that trail when you get to a bigger water.
Create a ditch instead of a trail.
Right.
And you can see this is a section of trail that's on the fall line. Like, water is going to want to go straight down the trail and therefore cut down. And this allows it to sheet off more and won't create that gullying that we would expect to see.
And this is a very old methodology that we've now started applying to trails. Like, the Romans built roads this way, and in a lot of places in the world, in South America, the cobblestone roads, you hear
streets,
about Tour de France, like, all of them are built with the rocks elongated and dug down and then flattened at the top, you know, by soil, and that just made that road last longer. And so when we apply that to trails, we get this, like, really incredible, durable surface on fall lines that are not...
Right, so you're not having to go back and redo it every single spring, after every spring runoff. So this will last...
Hundreds. Really, like, if the trail's gone and things grew over, this would be here.
Yeah. Future archaeological find.
Right. So do you think about now...
Go fishing?
Now that you know so much about trail maintenance, and now you're on these trails, and you're talking about, like, slope and sediment runoff, do you think about those whenever you're using a trail, like, recreationally, just for fun? Like,
a trail never looks the same. It will never look the same as before I did trail work. Because I'm like, oh, there needs to be a drain installed here. We need some steps on this section. You know?
Does it drive you a little
nuts? I am always
hypercritical
of anybody else's trail at this point. Yeah. But working with someone who understands, like, the slope of the land and how it lays and what the trail is being used for, and they can lay that out well without digging. It's still kind of a unique talent, you know, but I mean, that certainly plays a large role in how trails are formed and laid out.
So when you were growing up here, what do you think the trail use was like then and now? Like, increased, same?
I think it has definitely increased because of a lot of the in-town trails that aren't on the levee system in Alamosa. I also think because of Del Norte and the work they did up there, it's kind of becoming another Colorado mountain bike destination. You know, I worked with SCC in 2014, actually helping build a lot of those stone quarry trails.
So, like, people who lived here using trails, maybe not quite so much. And then definitely, like, the tourist or visitor use increasing since you were a kid to now, do you think?
I think so. I think people still come for the dunes because they've doubled their capacity. And, you know, they're staying in Alamosa. So now they can stay a couple days longer and do hike those trails,
paddleboard. So having trails in town is a draw for...
for that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm not a tourism expert, but it's a value added to keeping people in the valley to explore more of it. But it is going to continue to increase. I mean, with COVID, people were coming here because New Mexico was basically shut down. Mm-hmm. A lot of their recreation sites were closed. So I think that had a big impact, as well as just the Front Range and a lot of their recreation destinations getting closed.
All right, so we had to stop on the trail for a little bit because it's raining. So let's talk a little bit more about the impact of water on trails then, since we're in this like perfect spot of like, here comes all this rain and we're on a trail. What is, I guess, like a pet peeve or something that you would advise people to think about when they're using a trail and then to think about the water that's around them?
Go through the mud. That's my big thing, is don't go around it. Just go through it slowly and treading lightly. That keeps the soil there, and it's not going to widen and increase the chance of more soil eroding.
Because that's what you could see a lot, especially if you get these more flash, like a lot of water in a short period of time, and it's going to puddle up.
Yeah, and it's going to be temporary, and that's what people don't want to face is, oh, I don't want to go through this muddy puddle right now because it's inconvenient. Mm-hmm. When in reality, hey, if you wait or go through it very slowly, you'll be fine, and the trail will be better for it.
Cool. Mick, what's your number one?
I think when people use trails when it is muddy, like,
yeah,
you know, mountain bike specific trails and even hiking and running, though, they, and horses especially, like when trails are really wet and we put traffic on them, I mean, basically you're trenching it. Once it's trenched, you're holding more water on it. And now we have a water and erosional issue to deal with.
And that's a little different from like from a flash flood that you happen to be hiking and it's raining, so you don't really have much of a choice. But
right. Yeah,
if you're thinking about more, like if we have monsoon season and so we have weeks and weeks of a lot more rain, and then you're going out and mountain biking through stuff.
Or even in the spring when snow's still melting.
Right, snow melts huge. Yeah. People always, and I'm included in it. Like I've definitely found myself like, oh man, this trail wasn't ready. The right thing to do every time is turn around.
Yeah, which is hard when you're tired of being inside and you want to go outside and you'd like to be on that trail. And then you're in parts where the trail could be fine because maybe it's getting a little bit more sun. And so it's dried out faster. But then you get to those that are shaded.
And still snowy. Yeah. And therefore muddy. Yeah. And that's a lot of work. Like once you get that, I mean, if you don't have a maintenance crew that can get out there and work on it, it's going to stay that way for the entire season.
So you basically have kind of helped to ruin it for other people.
Yeah.
As we're walking up the trail, we're getting closer to that crew that is making a big difference with trail maintenance. This Rito Seco Trail has been under construction for several months. With funding from sources like Great Outdoors Colorado and Colorado Health Foundation, the Bureau of Land Management, and others, SLVGO has put together a team of experienced trail builders. Along with Contour Logic, which is a Colorado-based trail design company, GOATS, or the Great Outdoors Action Team, have laid rock barriers to prevent hillside erosion, built up natural slopes, and are in the process of constructing multiple footbridges over the Rito Seco. After hiking for just over a mile, we finally caught up to the 7-crew team.
I'm Logan.
And I'm Jimmy.
Jimmy. So Logan and Jimmy, and you guys are part of the GOAT. So you guys have been working on this trail for how long?
Oh, a month and a week now, or 2 weeks. Yeah, a month and 2 weeks.
In two separate sessions.
Okay.
So we had 5 weeks off, and we just are on our second week of four now. And then we had 6 weeks. Was it 6 weeks? 6 weeks last session back in June.
Wow. Yeah. And so you guys have been working how many miles?
Up to this point, it's a mile and a quarter.
So it's taken that long just to do a mile and a quarter. Yeah. So first things for people to think about is when you're on a trail that's longer than a mile, it's probably taken a huge amount of work to get it where it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, it takes time, especially coming into a canyon of the creek that we're working on here. It just kind of, it's very steep building.
Yeah.
So yeah. Everything has to have a lot of structure. Everything has to have sustainable work done on it so that it doesn't all rush into the creek.
I was going to say, because the creek is right there. Like maybe not even 100 yards.
Yeah, and we have 8 bridges crossing it.
Yeah.
This is what we're working on now, is our 7th bridge.
Okay.
Which has taken us like 2 days so far, and we still have a whole bunch more work to do.
And the whole point of a bridge is to keep people out of the water.
Keep people out of the water, keep the waterways healthy. As of now, it's really not the healthiest because we had to drop a bunch of trees.
Okay.
But the whole cleanup process, you know, is to go back through once we're done building the bridge and pick up all this lumber and get all this debris out of the creek once we're finished.
Yeah. And then we were talking earlier as we were coming up about the potential for really high water with spring runoff. Mm-hmm. And so you guys are clearing out these trees just in case we happen to get a really good snow year and it doesn't sweep them all downstream.
Ideally, yeah. And most of these bridges are built to like extreme high water, like gets high, but we're assuming higher. So,
So I do want to ask, because I'm very curious, because this is super incredibly hard work. Why do you do it?
Because it's hard work.
Because you like a challenge?
Oh, yeah, I love it. And it feels good to work on things that you use. Me and Logan both are avid trail users, so.
And what do you do on the trail, like when you're using it? I know you run.
I'm a runner, yeah.
And I'm mountain bike, and these are mountain bike specific trails as well, so
I think
it feels really good to do that.
This project specifically, I think, is super unique to the valley just because it is a mountain bike trail in the Sangre de Cristos.
Yeah.
The fact that the rest of them is wilderness and you can only hike and have horses, having this as a usage for the Sangres for a bike is incredible.
Because we're in the part of the valley where there's not a lot of public land, so there's not really a lot of opportunity for getting out, especially if you are from this area. You'd have to drive an hour or more to get to more public trails.
Totally.
So. And where are you from originally, Jimmy?
Originally from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Wow.
But I've been in Del Norte going on 7 years now.
Wow. And so what brought you to Colorado?
Originally just a summer gig with the Forest Service out of Del Norte. They're at the Divide office with the Forest Service there, working on motorized trails. And then, I just kind of stayed. Did that for 5 years. Kept coming back, so I just decided to be year-round and now I'm still here.
Got suckered in.
Yeah.
Can't leave. And you, Logan, I know you started at Adams State.
Originally from Colorado Springs.
Okay.
Came to Adams State, fell in love with the valley, and decided I liked building trails here.
Keep trying to find excuses to stick around.
Exactly. Yeah.
The other thing that I was asking Mick and Patrick earlier is, because this whole point of this podcast and this episode in particular is to try to educate the public about the trails that they're using and thinking about things that they maybe didn't know about trails. They just think, okay, I'm using it, I'm hiking on it. What would be the number one takeaway or advice that you would like to give someone who is using a trail, especially thinking about the water that is around them and maybe the ways that water can impact that trail that they're on?
Obvious one, stay the trail. I mean, staying on it, especially in an area like this, the reason, you know, giving access to people, but we don't want that access to lead to people walking the banks and eroding it even more. So it's important to stay the trail, and also just, I would say from a trail, but like a lot of hard work went into this and trying not to allow for, you know, debris to get into the creek, using all of our debris. Like there's a lot of effort that goes into it. It could go, like we were saying, it's taken a long time just to get a mile and a quarter. It would go a lot faster if we didn't take those precautions.
Yeah.
If we did just, you know, dig out the trail and throw all the materials downhill, that would, you know, we'd be done by now.
Yeah, but I think the bank stabilization is a good point, because you guys have done a lot of work at shoring up the sides with rock work to make sure that when we do get a lot of rain or snow or something, that it doesn't all come crashing down. And if people are hiking up on it and dislodging those rocks or moving into banks.
Totally.
That's a good point.
Absolutely.
And how Jimmy was saying, all the work that's put into this, the Contour Logic crew that's working with us, they started 2 years ago designing this trail.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they put in hundreds of hours of work to get to this point. And, like, the way it's designed is for the public. Like, we're not selfishly designing it the way we want to. It's for them to get this creekside experience and at the same time, you know, build a sustainable trail.
Yeah, because it is lovely to hike next to a creek. It's a lot cooler because you've got a lot more shade. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. Is if it's a trail that is designed with the public in mind, having the public understand what's expected of them is really important. It's kind of fun because we've got this creek noise right next to us. We're looking at this ginormous box of rocks, basically a cage that is filled with tons of rocks. What are you guys going to do with those rocks?
So what they do is they are basically the foundation for the bridge.
Okay.
So rather than pouring a big hole of cement, mm-hmm. we use literally a box of rocks to make the foundation for the bridge. So we'll end, as well as we're putting rocks on each side so that with high water, the water isn't washing away everything.
So what's better about using rocks than maybe concrete when it comes to like water coming through? Does it get compromised faster if you're using concrete rather than rocks?
You know, it's a very good question. And I think more than that, it's what's available, mm-hmm. rather than trying to haul in bags and bags and bags and bags of concrete.
Yeah.
In a setting like this.
Yeah, because we're in a very tiny, narrow slot.
Exactly. So. It's not like we can get a cement truck in here.
Sure.
You know, so this is kind of the next best thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So that it is a lot of hard work.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And so when you guys were coming down, you probably heard the rocks falling down. We're pulling rocks from the hillside.
Yeah.
So we're filling this, and then you can see over on the other side, they're starting to build the walls, mm-hmm. and we'll do the same thing on this side. Once we get kind of, again, the gabion set with rocks around it, then mm-hmm. we'll...
And so, building a bridge across this creek, you'd think it would be obvious, but I think sometimes maybe people need to be reminded that they should use the bridge because it's okay. there to keep the banks from eroding, and like that's
exactly.
the whole point of your really hard work in putting this in, is for people to actually use it and not go around it.
To stay on the trail, mm-hmm. and to give people kind of that gateway across, and quite honestly for safety as well, so they're not trying to walk across, you know.
Yeah, because some of these rocks have moss and
yeah.
they look a little slippery, and
exactly.
it would be dangerous to
yeah.
get on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Obviously, one of the things they got to take into consideration is, you know, whatever the flow is going to be at its highest level,
yeah.
right? So.
Yeah, because we're doing it right now at the end of the summer when lows are pretty low.
Yeah.
And then yeah. thinking about how that's going to interact in the spring runoff, we've
yeah.
been talking about that a lot. Yeah.
yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Machinery.
I was going to say, and the machinery, we've been talking about how much it helps. The trail. So how fast do you think this is moving versus if you had to do this by hand?
Oh my gosh. It's just, you can't even compare. the kind of work he can do on that, and then the other guy that got Aaron. I don't know if you've seen, did you guys go
mm-hmm.
up to, I mean, that's all machine cut.
Yeah.
And to cut that by hand.
Yeah.
You know,
those rocks are not
yeah.
small.
Yeah,
those
yeah,
are,
yeah.
I mean, they're not rocks. Those are boulders.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long have you been doing trail maintenance? Like just in general?
You know, I've done some volunteer work. I'm from Dallas-Fort Worth. So,
oh, wow.
I've done some there with my team and kind of the Dallas Off-Road Mountain Biking Association up there.
Okay.
So, yeah, a few years of that, and then just started with Mick and Patrick's group May, end of May.
So what do you think about when you're using a trail now versus now that you know what it takes to make a trail the
yeah.
way that it is? What do you think about when you're using the trail?
Well, I mean, the first thing is every trail I've been to since I started this, you just see things differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell how they're built. You understand what goes into them. You know, a lot of the stuff that you look at when it's done has so much rock work underneath it. And it took weeks and weeks to put together. And typically it's by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that stuff, you know, people don't really know how that goes. I didn't know how that went together
mm-hmm.
until I got out here, and it's it's a lot of work, and it's just a different setup in Texas. You know, the trails are more, you know obviously you don't have the mountains, so they're more
mm-hmm.
undulating and stuff. Where are you from?
I'm from the Austin area.
Okay,
so
yeah,
Harper
so you're from the hill country then.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's about as steep as it gets. You
yeah,
know,
but we don't have snow there, so that makes
right.
a big difference
yeah.
to the mountain trails that people are using in the summer, and they're not necessarily thinking, oh my gosh, what happens when there's, you know, many inches of snow and that has to come down eventually.
That's right.
And trails are the fastest way for them to come down.
They are. And so you've got to build that, that runoff into the trail where it drains properly, where it's not sitting on the trail and ruining the trail.
So what would you, being from Texas, say to people coming from other states who maybe don't think about the ways that water interacts with trails, what advice or takeaway would you want them to think about?
Oh gosh, I mean, when you design a trail, you have to look at it from the perspective of water and where water flows and how it flows. And it's really easy to design a really nice trail that, especially in Texas, when we get as much rain as we do, that can erode really, really quickly. So you have to have it designed, and these guys do all the design work for the drainages and stuff, but drained in a way that it gets off the trail.
So they're thinking as a user, because we've had some advice about, you know, making sure that you stay on the trail, even if it's wet.
Even if it's wet and muddy, yeah. Because then what you're doing is you're creating more trail and you're widening the trail.
Yeah. So that seems to be everyone's number one takeaway is, yes, it's not ideal to get your hiking boots muddy and nasty, but in the long run.
Yeah. It's better for the trail. It's better for everything around it.
Critical to trails are the youth element, the up-and-coming community members who are learning practical engineering skills through pick, hoe, and shovel, and earning a little bit of pay along the way. I'm sitting here with Aiden Howell, and she has been part of a trail crew for the past 2 years with Southwest Conservation Corps, and I wanted to get her perspective as a younger member of the community who has worked on these trails in our valley. Aiden, tell me why you wanted to be on a trail crew in the first place, because it's pretty hard work.
Well, I've grown up being outside with my family, and we love to go hiking a lot. And I guess I just felt like I had an obligation to help others experience what I experience on well-maintained trails.
What do you mean by well-maintained? Like, what to you is like a really well-maintained trail?
To me, it's one that doesn't have any damage, doesn't have anything on the tread where people walk, and a good place for water to get off the trail.
I'm glad that you mentioned water, because the point of this episode is to talk about also how humans interact with trails and how water's behavior impacts those trails. And then when you put the two together, you can either have really good results or you can have really terrible results. So my question for you then is, what have you seen since you've been working on trails? What are some really poor examples of human behavior?
Not staying on the trail, because there are instances where water will pool up on trails, and rather than getting their feet wet, people will walk around the puddles, and then everyone else behind them will see that and also choose to do that, creating a whole nother trail, which then my crew has to go and clean up and naturalize that part of the trail so that people will not.
So we want people to stay the trail, because people like you have to come along and do that extra work to even things out. When you started trail work, what was a big aha moment for you of now that you use trails? What do you notice?
I notice water drainages, check steps, and I now know how check steps are built and how they help. A check step is just like one of those stairs that comes out of the trail when it's starting to go downhill. So it's just easier for people.
It's keeping the water from just washing soil down the trail.
Yeah.
If it rains or we have a lot of snow melt.
I know how much it damages the environment around it, so I don't do that.
So not just the trail itself even, but you said the environment, so is that vegetation?
Yes, vegetation.
So like native wildflowers or bushes or anything that might help to hold that soil in place. If people go around it and trample that vegetation, they're impacting the ecosystem that's there. Nope. Why did you choose to decide to do a second year of trail crew?
I absolutely loved it. I loved the people that I was with, and and the experiences that I had, and it just taught me how to be a better leader, and I appreciate that.
And you're using a lot of different tools, so you were picking up some new skills along the way. Yes. What do you now feel proficient in?
I feel proficient in using a McLeod and a shovel.
Yeah. And do you feel empowered by that? Like, okay, I've done something for my community and I've done something positive for it as a community member, because you are doing something physical that you can point to and say, I did this on behalf of my community. How does that make you feel?
It's very empowering. I love it. I love to point out and be like, hey, I worked on that trail and it looks great, doesn't it?
Now it's time to end the episode with another Did You Know fact about the Rio Grande Basin. This cool fact comes from Patrick and our conversation about the ancient history of the San Luis Valley. Did you know that if you go south of Alamosa into the Brownie Hills area, you can actually see the outline of the prehistoric Lake Alamosa? Millions of years ago, this lake stretched almost 4,000 kilometers and was over 2,000 feet high in elevation. That about wraps up this episode. Listen to us on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or online at rgbrt.org. As always, thank you to our primary funders, the Colorado Water Conservation Board and the Rio Grande Basin Roundtable, as well as support from the Rio Grande Watershed Conservation and Education Initiative, who have all helped make this podcast possible. I encourage you to share this episode with your friends and family who are trail users, and maybe spark some discussion about the different uses of trails that are impacted by water and human behavior. And don't forget,
go through the mud.
People will walk around the puddles, and then everyone else behind them will see that.
Stay the trail.
Yeah, it's better for the trail, it's better for everything.